This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Teraflop GPUs aplenty.
And another HFT algorithm goes haywire.
Good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for August 10th, 2012. Available every Friday on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and I'm joined once again by Addison Snell of Intersect 360 Research. Hey, good morning, Addison.
Good morning, Michael.
We got some interesting news out of SIGGRAPH this week and a few other items, too. It's kind of a big week for the middle of the summer, but yeah,
it starts coming up. So SIGGRAPH, you can always count on for a bump. And as we've been looking forward to, we're actually getting some interesting news coming out of GPUs and out of the workstation space. So it's AMD and NVIDIA chipping in a lot of the news this week. Why don't we start with the new announcements from AMD?
Yeah, those were sort of the more interesting ones. I mean, AMD's sort of been a little quiet in the GPU computing realm of the GPU space, but this week, they announced six new, what they call their FirePro GPU processors for workstation users. And these are these dual-use things where they can do either this high-end visualization or computation. And the most interesting thing out of this is they announced a couple of these are going to have like ECC, which is, of course, the error correction that
right.
you need if you're going to be doing serious numerical calculations. That was like a big move for AMD, and if I'm not mistaken, these are the only ECC GPUs they have now.
Yeah, well, a lot of this announcement looked like they were playing catch-up to me. NVIDIA's had ECC in their Tesla
right.
Fermi line for quite a while.
Since 2009, right. It's been a while since they've had it. So, yeah, in that sense, you're absolutely right. They are playing catch-up.
But you pointed out to me that the double precision performance of this, with if you look at what's the double precision performance level on this new Fire Pro with ECC and compare it, that they're actually moving into the lead?
Yeah, I mean, temporarily at least. I mean, they, you know, AMD has always been pretty good on sort of their raw flops count on their GPUs. I mean, they didn't emphasize a lot of compute features per se, but the raw compute power has always been very good, and this one's no exception. They've got 4 teraflops of single precision and 1 teraflop of double precision, and right now that beats any other GPU computing chip on the market. The current Fermi top of the line is like at 665 gigaflops, and even their new Kepler they released that's not sort of the HPC version. It's pretty good on single precision. That's above 4 teraflops on single, but it's sub teraflop on double. So right now they sort of got this this lead on the raw performance all of
right.
a sudden.
So you get a teraflop of double precision performance plus ECC memory on a card.
Right, and these are
Fire Pro.
These are just intended for workstations, but you got to believe that this is going to turn into a server GPU at some point in the not too distant future. It's basically going to be the same card, and they'll be, you know, maybe they'll tweak it with different memory or something, and
right.
they'll turn off some of the visualization stuff. But I think they've given up on their Firestream line. It'll be Fire Pro, and maybe it'll be called something else. But I got to believe this is the precursor to some server GPUs that are going to come out and do basically the same thing that these workstations are doing, which is technical computing.
Right. This is the direction they're on with their APU computing strategy that they're coming out with these advanced processing units, their heterogeneous strategy. I agree with you. I think the Firestream is dead. We haven't heard anything about that. And
right.
I know some people who were associated with Firestream who got laid off, unfortunately. So I'm not really expecting to see anything future in Firestream here. I think this Fire Pro is their future. And I also think it's the nature of these processors or the chip wars in general that they tend to leapfrog each other on general performance. What NVIDIA and Intel have each successfully done is make it be more about more than just the performance. And NVIDIA is still going to hold a commanding lead over AMD in the near term with regards to the CUDA environment
right.
and other adoption factors.
Right. Plus the hardware features they have to support some of the compute features. So yeah, I mean AMD is really playing catch up here, even though they've got this this impressive performance metric out in front. And the other thing, you did mention APUs. Two of the new chips are APU chips, not the teraflop chip. They have two lesser APU chips. They announced four workstations and four computation that they just released, and they're much less performant. I think they topped out at the double precision was like in the hundreds, or between 100 and 200 gigaflops, and then a little more for actually a lot more for the single precision. But these, again, they're being aimed at technical computing. So these are the first APU chips. They're CPU GPU chips that are aimed for science and engineering codes, which is also interesting. And I think, again, these are the precursors to server chips that are going to occur down the line, probably further down the line than the discrete chips. But again, they're moving the APUs, I think, up the food chain as well.
Yeah, well, just because it's not in the server realm yet doesn't make it irrelevant for high-performance computing. We've been calling for developments on the workstation side for a while. And along those lines, NVIDIA had their own announcements this week with Maximus, you know, not to be outdone. So NVIDIA's got some workstation-level announcements also.
Right. In fact, they announced, they had basically their second-generation Maximus platform, which is the platform that combines basically a Tesla compute chip with a Quadro visualization chip in the same box. And this week they announced they're going to make the K20 Kepler chip available on the new Maximus platform. The K20, of course, is the one going into all these supercomputers in a few months, you know, Titan, Blue Waters, and some others. This is their HPC, their top-of-the-line HPC device that is going to be released, I think, probably, you know, in the November-December timeframe. And so they're actually going to extend this into the workstation space, too, and give those workstation guys a lot of power. That's expected to be more than a teraflop, probably more like a teraflop and a half of double precision. And, of course, all the ECC and all the fancy bells and whistles they put into the Kepler line to support GPU computing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's no secret that I love this type of deployment that NVIDIA has with Maximus. I think back to the salad days of the technical workstation when Sun and SGI would have these beefy 64-bit Unix running workstations that also had cool graphics. And it really integrated a lot of the entry-level CAE workflow onto the engineering desktop along with the CAD environment, and you know, that got broken over the years. I'd like to see that getting reintegrated. There's a little more software work that needs to be done, but companies like Ansys and Altair are making the right moves in that direction also. I think we're going to start seeing more there. I think this Maximus product is really in a sweet spot that can put the work back into workstation again for engineers. I even wrote a blog about this almost 3 years ago now called The Workstation is Sexy Again. You can still find it on our website under the research tab under features. You can probably still find it on HPC Wire if you did a search on sexy workstations. But, which, you know, everyone searches for all the time.
Of course.
But I think this is a real sweet spot. I'm glad to see NVIDIA coming out with a second generation here.
Yeah, and I think this should attract a lot of attention, especially people who, you know, who don't have small clusters or who are waiting for something else to happen as far as with their codes and don't want to make that jump into the server space. I mean, a lot of these companies have small clusters and workstations and they work in conjunction, but this puts a lot of numeric power on the desktop or the desk side, probably. It's hard to ignore that. And like you said, a lot of the software vendors are starting to port their applications there. A lot of them have already done so, and there's more and more every day with CUDA especially and OpenCL to a lesser extent. So there's actually more applications that are available now than ever before to actually work with that power and to get you know, teraflop GPUs, you know, in a single box that you don't have to stand in line to wait for some cycles on an HPC cluster, I think is going to be really attractive to people.
Now, you pointed out in your article on HPC Wire, Michael, that the one challenge that you have with something like this is your byte to flop ratio. And you're spot on that the trends of multi-core processors and then adding an attached GPU makes it a lot more difficult to get as much memory as you might like into into a system like this.
And it's exacerbated even with GPUs because they've got their own memory subsystems that actually to get to the larger main memory, the CPU memory, which isn't that big to begin with, considering how many flops you've got. You've got to go across the PCI bus. But yeah, I mean, there's always been this memory problem. If you can, you know, slice up your problem to into those memory chunks, you're fine. A lot of problems do that. But anything that's really data intensive, you've got very few bytes to feed those flop engines. And it's even worse because some of these Maximus platforms, they're going to add multiple GPUs. So you can consider that, you know, if you've got three of these GPUs in that box, you could have something like 5 teraflops to feed in that one system. And that's going to be great. But again, how are you going to feed all that?
Right. But these aren't going to be the first desktop systems that someone looked at and wished they had more memory on. I mean, this has gone with graphics intensive systems since the beginning of graphics that people have wanted more memory with them. This is not a new trend.
Yeah. And these, you know, the we don't even know how much actual memory is going to be on these boards. This is the K20s for the Maximus platforms. They're probably going to get at least 6 gigabytes because that was in the previous generation. I'm assuming a lot more, and there's going to be a lot of bandwidth. In fact, there's going to be more bandwidth, but it's still going to be sort of behind the eight ball, because again, they've upped the computational power so much that it's always like you're all sort of losing ground on the memory side here. It's the memory wall. We talk about this all the time, but still, it's still going to be attractive. I mean, there's a lot of computation power you are going to be able to access with these things. So I think, you know, there's probably some CAE and CFD engineers that are drooling at the prospect of having all this power on in their office.
Well, while we had good news coming out of SIGGRAPH, we had some rocky news coming out of Wall Street again. Michael, it seems like every once in a while we talk about high-frequency trading or algorithmic trading on this podcast, and it's not always good news.
Well, it's never good news. It seems like when we talk about it. I think the last time we devoted some attention to was back in 2010, where there was that flash crash.
Flash crash in May.
In May that, it was very systemic. It brought down the market for a while until the breakers came in. This looked like...
until we flipped the circuit breaker on it. What we learned that day was 18 minutes was how long it took computers to humans to re-seize control from the computers.
Yeah, which is better than they do in the movies. But this week, at the beginning of August, we had another snafu, which basically sounded like it involved one brokerage firm that lost a whole lot of money.
Right, Knight Capital Partners, a brokerage firm, had one of their HFT algorithms went rogue. And thanks to HFT, you can lose a lot of money a lot faster than you used to be able to.
Right. I mean, the whole thing about HFT is you make money very quickly, but a few errant bits, and all of a sudden you're going in the wrong direction just as rapidly. And
they misplaced the decimal point, and whoops.
Yeah, they lost something on the order of 400 plus million. This is just one company. I think we were talking beforehand. I think you were saying they're going to recover some of that money somehow. And nobody really knows how the money was actually lost or what the errant algorithm actually did. It's a little bit of a mystery, and I don't think anybody's going to be talking for a while on how that happened. But something bad happened, and all of a sudden, in the space of, I think, less than an hour, they lost hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, all right. So there's not a lot of detail around this story, but a couple of things. First of all, blaming the algorithm is a little bit silly. The algorithm is not intentionally going out and wreaking havoc. Someone wrote the algorithm. Someone pushed the button, right? So if you want to blame anybody, you can blame whatever oversight there's supposed to be around that process. The algorithm went out and did what it was told to do. And what you get with HFT is that if that algorithm is not what you intended it to do, it can really screw up the markets pretty fast. And the markets are efficient without them, to the point where an HFT that's doing the wrong thing is going to lose money, not make money. It's not like you're accidentally going to stumble across a pile of diamonds in the market that no one else already saw, and you're going to accidentally make $400 million.
Right, right. But I think that's sort of the disconnect here, and I think that's where this model gets in trouble. I mean, the people that write these algorithms are the quants, and these are not the traders. They're mathematicians. They're physicists in a lot of cases. And then the traders, they sort of trust this because 99% of the time they're just scraping the nickels off the floor and making, you know, millions of dollars, you know, over the course of months. So it works, but of course, it's software. So in any particular piece of software, you can't test all the boundary conditions and what's going on or all the environment around it. So when it goes wrong, you know, everybody, you know, is shocked. But, you know, these things happen. But the traders aren't going to understand what the algorithms are actually doing. They're traders. Only the quants would actually be able to decipher what actually went wrong.
Well, and then further to your point about the traders is that this is where risk management enters the equation, which is actually the larger, more complex, faster growing, more interesting segment within financial services that doesn't get talked about as much as the trading does. But the risk management position, even if you're doing daily risk management, which is already kind of best of breed, you're giving your trader a risk position, your portfolio manager a risk position that they have to be in at the end of the day. During the course of the day, you don't know where they went with that. They just know that they have to get back by the end of the day. Pushing that to intraday or continuous risk management so that you have less exposure to something is a nice lofty goal, but I'm not sure trading firms, brokerage firms know exactly how they're going to get there. There's, as you point out, very little oversight into how these things work, other than the motivation that I'd prefer not to lose $400 million in a couple minutes.
Exactly, right. I mean, and like I said, right, the traders are don't know the underlying technology very well. And even above the traders, there's, you know, the regulators, the SEC, they understand it even less well, and they don't even have the infrastructure to monitor these things. So they're going to be the last in line to sort of halt things. It's sort of an odd model. There's a discontinuity of technology and knowledge here that a lot of people think is just sort of out of control now. And, you know, there are some circuit breakers that are in effect, but
The circuit breakers are not as fast as the algorithms. That's the problem. Is it, you know, the traders have always made mistakes, right?
Right.
But you make mistakes in small batches. One of these algorithms goes, and the Time Business article pointed out that it was, or claimed that it would trade thousands or millions of executed trades in a second. I think that's an overstatement. It might be offering that many. It's not executing that many. But still, you've got all of these offers that are out there. And if that goes wrong, and it takes you a few minutes to turn it off, to stop it, it's already caused a lot of damage. You have the ability to make mistakes so much faster.
Right. Yeah, and I think the circuit breakers are basically to protect the larger market. And I think that's probably in effect because basically they're trying to prevent the market from crashing. But to prevent little pieces from crashing, they really can't do that. And really the bigger problem is, I think sort of the structure of this is how it's sort of distorting some of the trading that's going on in the market and sort of even sort of the risk profiles of these different things, because when there's so much liquidity and there's so much sort of what this is really speculation going on, that distorts the market and the fundamentals, which people are using basically to make long-term investments for this market. But when you have this going on, it really does distort it. That's really the larger issue here.
Yeah, well, it's a game theory problem that you introduce the technology to do one thing and then people will try to figure out how to intentionally misuse it to their advantage. And then sometimes that goes wrong. And then, you know, you wind up here, and now, so we'll find out what happens with Knight Capital in the long run. But we did want to come back around to this story because we've talked about it before, that these HFT algorithms, as excellent as they are at making the markets even more efficient a lot of the time, sometimes hit a pothole.
Yeah, and I have a feeling this won't be the last time we report on this.
Nope.
Okay, well, that should wrap up our show for the day. I think we've got some interesting news coming up for next week that I have some pre-knowledge of, but we'll wait until then to get to it. And until then, I guess we'll talk to you.
You know all, Michael, but you share it in time.
All right.
Thanks, Michael. Talk to you next week.
Thank you.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.